great pleasure to welcome you all on behalf of AVAC to the second in what we hope to be a series all year on some of the major themes and issues in HIV prevention research and reality. All of these calls, the slides and the recordings are archived, and we will provide the link both to this call but also to the whole series on the web, and we'll talk about that toward later in the call. The last call was kind of an overview looking at many different issues, including the one that we're going to zero in on and discuss today, which is related to hormonal contraception and HIV, an issue that I know many of you on the line have been tracking, and this is a number of calls that we and other organizations have had over the last couple of years, and you'll understand why that is so in just a bit. We're going to start with an overview presentation from Professor Helen Reese, who I'll introduce in just a moment. We will then open it up to questions and some additional data that was just presented last week as well at the Retrovirus Conference. And we're happy, really want to take questions throughout the call. If you're on the web interface, you can put your questions in the chat box there, and we will make note of those. You can also email at any point this morning to avac@avac.org. And after Helen's presentation, we'll open it up for questions, and you'll be able to hit *7 to unmute your line, and then we do ask that you hit *6 to mute again to keep the line clear for the recording so that we can put it on the web. We have about an hour. Inevitably, we will, I'm certain, raise many more questions than we will have time to answer. And we really hope that this is a conversation that will continue and with some urgency over the next several months. There have been a number of conversations and presentations, as I say, on this over the last couple of years. So it is an evolving conversation with an evolving database, and I'm really delighted to invite Helen Reese to provide an overview to the conversation before we get started. I think anyone working in HIV prevention research and in reproductive health knows Helen and her work, currently the executive director of the VITS Reproductive Health and HIV Institute, WRHI, based in Johannesburg, and working throughout South Africa and internationally on a whole range of issues. Helen is going to provide a bit of an overview to start with slides, and then again we'll take it for questions. So without further ado, let me go ahead and welcome you, Helen, and we can certainly advance the slides and go through it.
Thank you. Can you hear me, Mitchell?
Yes, perfect.
Okay, and you will advance the slides. Thank you. Hello, everyone. I'm going to go through the slides fairly quickly because, as many of you will be familiar with the data, this is data that we have presented before. There are a couple of new data sets that I'll just speak to briefly at the end. But I think we really wanted to have most of the time on this call for discussions about the next steps, and particularly looking at the arguments for and against the randomized control trial, and rather randomized clinical trial, and what that might look like. I don't know, is Jared on the line, Mitchell?
Jared is on the line, and I know he's going to be taking some questions and engaging in the conversation as well.
That's excellent. Okay, so I'm going to give you a summary of where we are with hormonal contraception and HIV, but there's a little bit of additional data that I'll speak to at the end. Do you want to go to the slide?
Yes.
I'm not moving. Are you moving?
I moved him. Are you not seeing it?
No.
Then we have a delay. Let me see. Angela or Diego, are you able to? Oh, great.
I got it now.
Super.
So when you're thinking about contraception and HIV, there are essentially, particularly in high prevalence settings, there are two groups of women one has to consider. Women who know that they are infected with HIV, in which case the considerations are about their infectiousness to partners, whether any contraception will have an impact on disease progression, positive or negative, and particularly with ARVs and hormonal contraception, questions of drug interaction. The larger group of women will be women at risk of HIV. who might be HIV positive but simply not know their status, but might be HIV negative, and in which case the two issues one would need to think about is what the impact is of the contraception on HIV prevention. And here, of course, both the male and female condom would be a contraceptive method that are also dual methods in terms of HIV prevention. But also, and this is the issue that we've all been discussing for some time, do any contraceptive methods make a difference on HIV acquisition, either positively or negatively? Next slide. Sorry, there is a bit of a delay on my side. Okay, I'm not getting this through.
Do you have the next one, Helen?
No, I don't, unfortunately. I do now, but it's slow. And what I'm trying to do at the same time is print it, so even if I don't have it up on the screen, I can talk to it.
Great.
So in terms of progestin contraceptives, we all know that there are progestin injectables, there are implants, there are progestin-only pills, but the progestin cells are different, and they have different chemical structures. And we know that at a cellular and a molecular level, and in terms of the immune response, they actually behave differently. And there have been extensive studies that have started, well, not extensive, some are more extensive than others, but studies have started to look at what the differences are between these products. Next slide. This gives you a list of the progestin types by structure. And you can see that there are progestins that are related to progesterone and others that are related to testosterone. And I won't go through the list, but you can see that different products have quite different characteristics in terms of how we can characterize them with respect to other hormones. Next slide. Progestin contraceptives, therefore, differ. And as we've said, they differ in terms of their chemical structure. And they have also different pharmacokinetic parameters. What this means is that if you give, for example, an injectable versus giving an oral pill, you're going to get very different levels in the blood and in the tissue at different times. They'll stay in the body and they'll stay in the blood and they'll stay in the genital tract at different times according to the product and how it's made available. They also have different bioavailability orally and vaginally, meaning that different products and different formulations will allow for different amounts of the synthetic hormones to be made available in different areas. They have different progestational potency, which is what it says. It's how potent is this as a steroid. And they work via different steroid receptors. These are steroids, and that's very important when we start to try and unpack how they work at molecular level. They work via different steroid receptors, which means they have different side effects, different safety profiles, different benefits. And the binding, however, doesn't equal activity. So we can't say if something works in this particular way that it works in that particular way. The possible impact of progestin varies from sites in the body and in terms of the function of that cycle. They can act on the vaginal cervical epithelium, on the cervical mucus, and certainly the injectable progestins particularly work via the cervical mucus. They alter menstrual patterns and do this in different ways. And they've been demonstrated to alter vaginal immunology. As you said, receptor concentrations and types vary by cell and tissue type, and those are influenced differently by these different contraceptives. And steroid-induced modulation of receptor concentration, that viral HIV replication can be affected, and also they might have an influence on acquisition of other STIs and therefore indirectly impacting on HIV acquisition. Next slide. Still waiting. I don't know if it's just my line or everybody's line. It might be just mine that's very slow. There we are. This gives you a demonstration of how these products really do differ if you see the blue line with a very steep increase and then the slow decline, this is depo-provoked. And you can see that, as you might expect, if you put a large dose of hormone in a depo formulation into the body, you get an immediate, very, very high blood level. And then it slowly reduces down, and at 3 months, that's why you boost it again with the MPA. You'll see something similar with myristate, but at 2 months, it would have declined to the other levels. If you see at the beginning of this chart, you can see that other products, such as Implanon in the red triangle, when it's implanted, starts with a much, much lower level and a much more steady release of hormones. And the IUD, it's very difficult to see it here, but has very low levels because what you're getting is progestins released from the uterus, and it's the action there is much more local and not about actually getting significant levels in the blood. Next slide. I think, Mitchell, what I'll do is, in the next slide, What I'll do is I will tell you next slide, perhaps a little bit ahead of finishing talking about the slide, to try and get us.
Sounds great.
In terms of the epidemiology, you can see that the distribution of injectable progestin contraceptive use is very strongly concentrated, again, in terms of South and East Africa. Next. And we also know that if we look in the African region, where we seem to have this particular perfect storm of high use of injectables and high HIV prevalence, this is looking at 6 countries. If you look at the green bars of injectables, you can also see that amongst women who are currently married, if we take Malawi as an example in the middle, women who are currently married versus women who are not married, there are different patterns of use and different patterns of use of the different methods. And you can see here, and you can go to the next slide, that condoms are more commonly used across the board in non-married women. Now if we look at the adult HIV prevalence, and we go to the next slide, you can see once again here, South and East has this epicenter of the HIV epidemic still. Just waiting here. And the next slide should superimpose. My computer didn't like that. Okay, my computer's now gone completely dark. So I'm going to go and get a printout of this. But the next slide, if I'm correct, Mitchell, you probably got it up in front of you.
Yes, go ahead.
Okay, that should show the map showing injectable progestin distribution and HIV distribution.
Exactly.
Okay. So this is all, however, observational data, and you can't derive cause and effect from this. You can't say, because there seems to be a lot of progestin use, so there's a lot of HIV, therefore one equals the other. It could be that progestin use is a signpost for all sorts of other behaviors that can increase HIV risk. So you really cannot say that it's cause and effect. If you get the next slide up, Mitchell, I'm going to go and try and get a printout, so I'll have to talk because my computer's actually gone blank. Yeah. I think we completely died from the presentation. So keep going.
So bear with us, everybody. We're going to be back on the acquisition research timeline in just a second. Helen, are you there?
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead, Helen.
Sorry, I'm so sorry about this. We're really having IT problems.
Not a problem. We have the acquisition research timeline up now.
Exactly. So you can see that this discussion has been going on since 1987, and in 1996, the Preston Mark publication looked at macaque monkeys and SIV acquisition and showed that there was a really very significant increased risk of HIV, of SIV acquisition in the monkeys at particular points of the menstrual cycle, up to a six-fold increase. And this, of course, caused enormous alarm. We keep going. And from then on, you can see that this was in 1996, you can see that a number of other publications have shown that progestin increased risk of SHIV with SIV in the animal models, and so much so that we now use very high doses of injectable progestins to prime non-human primates, particularly for HIV vaccine and microbicide research. Next slide. However, we can't extrapolate that to the human condition. So the basic scientists you'll see from this example have done a lot of work trying to understand what the effects of different types of progesterones are on the immune system with relation to HIV. And they've looked at all sorts of impacts in terms of receptor cells, cytokines, all sorts of different aspects of what is the effect in terms of the interface with the immune system. Again, one of the problems is although we can see that things happen, and we can see, for example, that Depo-Provera DMPA is very different to NetN in the way that it behaves, we can't derive any conclusions about what that means clinically in women. Next slide. Still not coming up yet. Okay, well, I've now gone to the WHO's medical eligibility criteria. So this is fine. Let's look at this. So the WHO's medical eligibility criteria is a way that WHO has derived over a number of years to try and evaluate, to try and consolidate research that's done and actually make sense of it and interpret it for clinical guidelines. It's a very evidence-based process. It's a very rigorous process. And the gold standard of the studies, and you can go to the next slide, that they look at are randomized clinical trials. They then classify, once they've looked at all this data, they grade the data, which is classified according to the strength of the data and the type of study design, and then they classify it into a one, where there is no restriction on use. For example, you can use hormonal contraception freely if the person has, if the person is 16 years old, under 18, you can use it freely. A two, where the benefits generally outweigh the risk. Three, where the risks generally outweigh the benefits. So this might be, for example, an IUD in somebody who has a past history of a sexually transmitted infection. And four, there's an unacceptable health risk, and that would be putting an intrauterine device into someone with an active chlamydial infection, for example. So that's how it's classified. Next slide.
So, Helen, the 2008 MEC recommendation is up here now.
Yeah, okay. So the normal consultations in 2008, they looked at all of the available data for DNPA, and there was very little data on NetN. So they tended to, at this stage, NetN, erythrate, was bunched under DNPA. They looked at all of the evidence, and they found that there was the balance of the evidence suggested no association between progestin contraceptives. Although they noted at that stage that DMPA use amongst higher risk populations had inconsistent findings. You can go to the next slide, I'll keep speaking. What they noted in 2008 was that younger women and one particular study from Kenya looking at sex workers, there was an increased risk of HIV acquisition amongst women using DMPA, but it wasn't at a population-based studies did not show that finding, but they did note that then. In July 2011, then there was a new study that was presented at the IAS conference in Rome and was also published. Next slide. And in this study, they looked at it was a prospective cohort study based on the partners in prevention study, which wasn't primarily designed to look at this, but nonetheless collected very good observational data on the relationship between hormonal contraception and acquisition. They looked at, you can go to the next slide, they looked at 3,790 discordant couples. And these were the results that caused some concern and a lot of discussion. That was that there was an increased risk of HIV acquisition from men to women of 1.98 for any hormonal contraception, and for injectables, just over twofold increased risk, and these are statistically significant. We can move on. So this data was, it was a well-done observational study, but it was still an observational study, and observational studies have inherent limitations, in that although you try and measure all sorts of other factors that might influence the results, one's always aware that you can't measure everything. There might be things going on that you just don't, that you can't measure. So to actually say that any observational data really cast iron evidence is extremely difficult to do, you really start to rely on randomized trials, or you rely on a lot of observational data that is consistently going in the same direction. So this was then interpreted, the media then had its own interpretation of it, and while there was some quite measured interpretation from media in some countries, this was the front line here is from the Nairobi newspaper, where the headline was contraceptives double HIV risk. Now, of course, the problem with this, and you can go to the next slide, is that once you put something like this into the public domain, if you're not sure of what you're saying, what you can do is scare women off from using a method or scare users off providing the method, offering the method, when in fact you haven't got conclusive evidence. So in January 2012, and you can go to the next slide while I'm talking, there was a big Geneva consultation with 75 participants, 18 countries, and they looked again at all of the data on HIV acquisition, transmission, and progression. They rated the evidence using this grade process, and they looked at the current NEC criteria and said, were we right? And we're focusing, obviously, in this discussion on HIV acquisition. So at that stage, this was the data that they looked at. You can see that the studies where the triangles are to the left of one would indicate that products are protective, and if the triangles are to the right, they're harmful. But where studies have very broad confidence intervals and they cross over that vertical line of one, these mean that these studies are not going to be very reliable for interpretation. You really want to see a study that has tight confidence intervals and is sitting very firmly on one side or another or the other of that line. So what you could see is that some of the better observational data was tending to sit firmly to the right-hand side and the harmful side of this plot. Next slide. And in the next slide, when it comes up, there are even more studies showing that have looked at this, that came out subsequent to this WHO consultation. And you can see that there are studies to the left, there are studies that cross the midline, and there are some studies where they look at that there's an increased HIV risk to the right of that vertical line one, and they do not cross the midline. And it was these studies which, as I said, tended to be quite well done observational studies, but also caused more of the debate. Moving on to the next slide. So WHO had a major discussion about this in that meeting, and the real difficulty is that this is obviously, as I mentioned, this can have what's called selection bias. These are things that you think you've thought of everything, but you might not have measured it, and you might not have. And it could really be determining what you're seeing, not what you're concluding. This is called a potential for confounding your results. Very often in many of these studies, this wasn't the primary study endpoint. The studies were not designed to look at this. They were designed to look at something else. And this was a secondary analysis or a secondary objective. The use of hormonal contraception in some of these studies wasn't well documented. And in some, generally, self-reported condom use is known to be unreliable. And we also knew that from a lot of the studies, they were comparing to non-hormonal contraceptive arms, where condom use was almost intrinsically different from those in the hormonal arm. Move to the next slide. And in 2012, this statement came out, which tried to capture the complexity of the debate, but in fact caused a fair amount of confusion among activists and journalists. So the first thing which was important is that the group at that stage said we should not change current guidance. It would mean, if you remember, the MEC number one, as it was in 2008, that there was no concerns at all. But because what they also then gave a caveat, because of the inconclusive nature of evidence, women using progesterone-only injectable contraception should be strongly advised to also always use condoms. And there was also a recommendation to policymakers and program managers to weigh up for themselves the complex balance of risks and benefits. And there was a strong recommendation to expand the method mix and for further research on the relationship. Next slide. In the next slide, once again, we can see that the media, the confusion in the message was reflected in the media. What you'll see as we get to the next slide, you might be there already, actually, so let me talk to us. The Guardian says HIV warning to women using injectable contraception. And the Star in Kenya says hormonal contraceptives, WHO assures. So this interpretation really, as you can imagine in the field, and many of you have been part of it, has caused confusion. Can we move to the next slide? So some women approached WHO and said, we don't understand this, and journalists similarly, and asked for a further consultation with women's organizations, activists, and journalists, which WHO then hosted. Some researchers and donors said, well, perhaps we need this definitive study as WHO has recommended, and would that be a randomized trial? There was a widespread call for increasing the message mix in developing countries, and I think the one good thing we can say about that is that I think that this has been widely listened to. What this has done, if nothing else, at the moment, is to really show how we've really allowed contraceptive offerings to be diminished to, very, in many places, one or two methods. The modelers became involved, and in the next slide, they looked at all of the data, and they modeled it. And I'm just giving examples of three models that were all published. As with all models, you know, they say models are helpful, but they're all wrong. Basically. And they have different assumptions, different algorithms, and different levels of rigor. But all of these three models that were published showed that the conclusions about this interface and what the impact, if it's real, of an increased risk of DNPA would be on HIV incidence. All of them concluded that this would vary tremendously between countries, that if you withdraw, you have increased pregnancy, which has consequences of its own in terms of maternal and infant mortality and increased risk of HIV acquisition due to pregnancy. And that all of them recommended that they're expanding the method mix, including whether it would be wise to consider other long-acting reversible contraceptives such as implants and IUDs, or oral, but noting that orals and condoms had a high failure rate. There's two other studies that have come out, and some of you might have been at CROI or might have heard this, and this is from the MTN study, where the VOICE study, MTN-003, and Jared's on the line and he can speak in more, but I'll give you just a very brief headline of that. And what that showed was for women in that study, and there were significant numbers, and they were able in this study to actually look for really the first time properly, I would say, at the difference between DMPA and NetM, because they had significant numbers of HIV seroconversions in each group. In total, they had 150 women becoming HIV positive who were using DMPA and 54 who were using NetM. This meant that they then looked at it further, and they looked at women who are HSV2 negative and women who are HSV2 positive. In the HSV2 positive group, they showed that the HIV incidence was 9.99 versus the NetN group where it was just over 5. That finding was not repeated in the HSV2 negative group. So what they found was that almost twofold increased risk of HIV acquisition amongst women using DMPA versus NetM for those who are HSV2 positive. Another study that's come up was from the microbicide development program, which similarly had about 11,000 women in a microbicide study. They also looked at injectables overall and DMPA. They also looked at NetM, and their summary was the following. They said that the crude incidence rate suggests a relatively large increased risk associated with both injectables, DMPA and NetM. But they went on to say that this was largely explained by confounding, particularly the age and the different centers in that study. The results were consistent across centers and age groups. And then they ended up with the final conclusion, which was consistent with previous studies. A small increased risk of HIV remained for women using DMPA, although they still could not rule out residual confounding because of this problem of this being observational data. So those are two additional studies that have come out. So we're really left in the next slide with this question of what are the next steps? How do we tease this out? Do we have enough data to make further decisions yet? What do people feel? Or do we really have to do a definitive study, noting that just getting more and more observational data is probably unlikely to break this logjam? I'll stop there, Mitchell.
Great. Helen, thank you so much, and thank you for working through the technical challenges. And I know some other people might have had similar delays in the slides, but incredibly helpful. And I, again, want to thank you and definitely want to open it up for questions and conversations. I do want to just acknowledge Jared Baton, whose name you've seen in a couple of those slides, is on the line as well. So too is Lisa Noguchi, who led the Microbicide Trials Network study that was presented at the retrovirus meeting last week that Helen referred to. And what I might do is just very briefly ask if they wanted to make any additional comments, and then we'll open it up. And again, in the web chat, please include your questions or at avac@avac.org, and in a moment, *7 to unmute your line. But first, Jared or Lisa, anything you want to add to what Helen just presented?
Mitchell, can you hear me now?
Yes, go ahead, Lisa.
Sure. Now, I think Helen did an excellent job of summarizing what we found in VOID. I don't think I actually have anything to add. Maybe just that in VOID, we really had the opportunity to, because this was a planned analysis from the beginning of VOID, to look at these questions, we were able to collect a lot of detail about when women were using contraception and what types they were using, and able to get a little bit more data on NetN than some previous studies, because that was an area where the field thought we were lacking some information on that particular injectable method, HIV acquisition. So I think we had a good opportunity to do that in VOID. I think that's the only thing that I would add. I think Helen summarized the challenges associated with observational research and sort of the strength of what we've done in VOID very well. So thanks.
Great. Thanks, Lisa. And I will put in the follow-up email. Lisa was both presenting the poster at the meeting last week, but also part of a panel discussion, and we will be sure to send around the web link for that to see her presenting the findings specifically and also some discussion that ensued afterwards that's available via webcast. And Jared, if you want to hit *7 to unmute, if you wanted to add anything.
Thanks, Mitchell. Can you hear me now?
Yes, indeed. Welcome.
Great. And good morning, good evening, everyone. I don't have much beyond what Helen said, and Helen, thank you for doing such a great overview. I think what's important to reinforce is that, you know, although there have been many years of people asking these sort of questions, it has really been in the last very few that there has been an acceleration in trying to really pull together the evidence in an important and strong way to change what policies are, what options are for women. And that is part of what the conversation is here. And I think Helen showed that well, that how the conversation is beginning to change to try to figure out what the real answer is, so that people can have good information to make policy choices, clinician choices, and women making choices for their own contraception. The other thing is, it's very great that Lisa's on. One of the points that's been very important for the scientists in the field is trying to provide strong scientific information. This is a type of a scientific question for which there can be muddled answers, and strong analytical approaches like those that Lisa used are really what the field needs right now. So I think we should really be thankful that Lisa's been able to do this and do it so well. Thank you.
Great. Thank you so much to all of you. And again, *7 to unmute your line if people want to join, or the chat function, or via email. Let me just open up the line first, and then we'll go to some of the questions that have come in. Anyone, *7 on the line? All right. Well, I wonder, a couple questions happily did come in actually before the call even started from people sending in some emails. And I know this is a question that will be very different depending on the country, but I wonder, Helen or Jared or Lisa, if you wanted to talk about what options women might have in particularly the countries that you were describing in that overlay map, Helen, of where we see that relationship, although we don't know, as you said, if it's causative or not. But what other options do women actually have in those key countries where we have high prevalence and high DMPA use?
I'll kick off and then others can join in. Can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
The options were becoming, as I mentioned earlier on, somewhat reduced. So countries, for example, that had much higher uses of the copper intrauterine device some years ago were sort of tending to drift away from that and towards particularly injectables. One of the things in the region that's happened, though, is that the introduction of implants has occurred in some countries very successfully, for example, in Zimbabwe. So we know that it's possible and it's cost-effective to introduce other alternative methods. Overarchingly, as I say, the dialogue that's going on now in many countries is the need to broaden the method mix, but also specifically to make sure that we have more what are called long-acting reversible contraceptives available, and particularly the implants and the copper IUD. We didn't show that data here, but the very, very limited data that we have on the copper IUD hasn't suggested an increased risk of HIV acquisition, which might be counterintuitive to many of us, and it's very limited data, but at least the data that's available is somewhat reassuring. So clearly it's an area we'd need more studies, but it certainly isn't hinting in the same way as in the past the DMPA data hinted. So I think that that's where we are, and there is a sort of global policy move to try and make available more of these long-acting reversible contraceptives to women for the sake of their convenience. Over.
Great. And I wonder, just apropos of that, Jared, in amongst your various hats, you're also the principal investigator on the ASPIRE study of the dapivirine ring. And I know there's been talk of expanding the contraceptive mix in that trial. I wonder if you wanted to, you know, it's easy to say let's expand the method mix, but perhaps you can give us a sense of how feasible that is.
Thanks, Mitchell. You can hear me, right?
Yes.
Great. So in ASPIRE, it's not just talk about expanding the method mix. We really have, and this is a testament to some very creative thinking by the Greater Aspire team on how to provide contraceptive options and, as a result, expand method mix at the study sites. As you know, Aspire is a randomized trial to piperine ring for HIV prevention that's occurring at 15 sites in 4 countries, South Africa, Zimbabwe, Malawi, and Uganda. And as part of the study, women are using contraception and are offered contraception on site. What became unique within Aspire is that the study team decided to make a robust effort in light of these kind of data to expand method mix. And now all study sites in Aspire offer a range of contraceptive options. Not only oral contraceptive pills and injectable DMPA, like Helen said, in many settings are the available options and sort of the extent of the range of the mix, but also in the South African sites, Neden, which is mainly used in South Africa, but most interestingly, all study sites are offering IUDs and implants. Hormonal implants, which encouragingly have just been approved for use and licensed within the last 6 months in South Africa and are undergoing a big rollout now, which is incredibly encouraging. In Aspire, as a result, the contraceptive mix has gone from what would be expected in the study, in the region, which would be very highly injectable DMPA, perhaps some mix of Neden and South African, maybe some mix of oral contraceptives, to really the panoply of all of those options, where really demonstrating that when options are available, people choose them. I'm very encouraged about the uptake of the IUD and the implant, as Helen said, long-acting reversible methods that have been in Aspire highly acceptable and highly used with huge proportions of people in the study now using each of those methods. It's really very encouraging, and I think it demonstrates that when options are made available, women will take advantage of them and will take advantage of the option that works best for them. All the more reason to diversify the method mix in really every setting.
Fantastic. You know, we've had a bunch of questions that have just come in from a number of advocates talking in different ways about next steps. So I definitely want to get to three issues as quickly as we can. One, as someone pointed out, as Helen described, there was a meeting specifically about DMPA and HIV risk now several years ago at WHO, which resulted in the very slight but insufficient adjustments related to potential risk. The comment, just use a condom in addition to DMPA. And there is another meeting this week in WHO of the full medical eligibility criteria, not specific to this issue. And I wonder, question came in here, is the data that Lisa Noguchi, you talked about and presented last week at CROI, is that being considered as additional data from what was seen in the past, as well as the MDP data, Helen, that you described? And what might happen in the conversation in Geneva is the first point of next step. So do any of you want to kind of weigh in on that?
Mitchell, I can speak up a little bit to that. So first of all, the meeting at WHO, there's actually a deadline. They have a process by which they collect and review studies, and our data were not available at the time that they made the cutoff for materials for review, and they generally review published material. So it's possible that in the future, once the study is published, and we're hoping to get that manuscript submitted as soon as we can, that at that point it would be considered for review in a formal sense at WHO. But I would definitely welcome any comments from Helen and others who've been involved in those reviews before.
Great. Thanks, Lisa. Helen, did you want to add anything about that?
No, I don't have insight into this. I mean, I've motivated and encouraged the group to look at all of the available data, including the MTM, the MDP, and the Charlie Morrison's meta-analysis. And sometimes in those meetings, they, in addition to the proper grade of data, they will listen to other pieces of data that have at least it's admitted the cutoff. So, but I don't have insight into what the strategy would be, unfortunately. I don't know if Jared does.
No, I don't have any further comment. Obviously, we are. It's happening today, I believe, in outside Geneva. I think what's important is to be, I think, never slowing down on trying to move towards good answers here. I think that, you know, individual observational studies do not in themselves change all of policy, but it is the collection of that will. And so continuing to contribute to that with good science, press from an advocacy point of view for good work to be done and for people to be listening to good science, and at the same time to be making changes already. I think changes in expanding method mix should be happening regardless of what regardless of how well the policy or the science are changing, because changes in method mix offer more options, which I think is always a great idea.
Great. Thanks, Jared. And actually, that's a perfect segue into a question about evidence and data. Because a number of people have written in via email and on the web chat asking about a proposed randomized clinical trial. And Helen, you referred at the very end to the open question about that. Jared and Helen, you've both been very involved in the discussions related to a trial that in the AVAC report we described in some detail as a proposed four-arm trial called ECHO. And I wonder, given the data emerging, increasingly emerging, as well as the conversations at WHO and the need for this evidence, if either one of you might provide an insight into where the ECHO trial is now, and particularly with a view to the timeframes for decisions and next steps, and perhaps also comment on roles for advocates, both on the ground in Africa especially, and we have some colleagues from ICW who have been very involved in this issue, as well as advocates globally, to be engaged in this conversation. So does either one of you want to start off? I guess I shouldn't have asked it that way.
You have to ask directly.
I have to ask directly. Jared, I hear your voice. Do you want to give a quick insight, and then we'll go to Helen?
I can give a quick insight. Thanks, Mitchell. So for over a year now, a group, a multinational, multidisciplinary group of scientists has been trying to come together on what would be an intelligent and careful and well-constructed idea for a randomized clinical trial to assess whether there is increased HIV risk, but also the additional contraceptive benefits and other factors related to different methods of contraception. At points in the discussion, I think we've had as many as jokingly as many as 9 or 12 different arms, because there's many, many contraceptives out there that that would be interesting to explore. But certainly those that have been that we have discussed the most strongly, because they are most relevant because of their high acceptability and high use and where the question is most pressing, are injectable DMPA, injectable NetN, hormone-containing implants, which are increasing in popularity in many settings, as I said before, are rolling out in South Africa, and then a non-hormonal contraceptive that is quite effective and quite acceptable, which is the intrauterine device. This the team, which meets very, very frequently to move its plan forward, has begun the operational considerations for what a trial might look like, and begun on the drafting of protocol, including contacting with outside scientists and advocates to comment on how we should be thinking about this. A trial at this time is not completely funded, but the potential funders have been very, very engaged in thinking about how to make this question answered the best it can be and the most expeditiously. So I think that's where we stand right now. I'll let Helen comment a little bit.
Yes, I think one of the challenges with a study of this nature is that as with a lot of these HIV prevention studies, is that it has to be very large by its very nature, and therefore it's very expensive. So one of the challenges, as you said, Arthur, is that we were hoping to do a four-arm study, but the cost of that would be so high that the chances of us raising the funds for that are unlikely. So one of the big debates has been if we have to do a three-arm study, which would be the three arms? I think the other thing, and Gerard raised it just now, since the last WHO consultation, with the three new pieces of data available that weren't available to that consultation, would we see a change in the MEC guidance? If the MEC guidance goes to a 2, if you remember what that was, that the benefits generally outweigh the risks, that 2 also has a caveat built into it by its definition, which says, or where there are theoretical risks. So if the MEC, if the expert committee decides to move it, and what I think quite good about this meeting is that they're not just the experts in this field. They're experts in the epidemiology of contraception more generally, and some of them will have expertise in cardiovascular disease, et cetera. So I would hope that quite a number of them will be looking at this with fresh eyes, which I think will benefit the field. So let's see what happens there. If it stays a 1, it begs the question of, what do we do with all this new data and how do we get that factored in the future into WHO's considerations? If it moves to a 2, it certainly doesn't mean that DMPA has to be taken off the market, but it implies that slightly more strongly than this 1 would be out of the condoms does. And does that actually, is that then an imperative to go and do this randomized trial? Does that push us in that direction? Or does it say that perhaps the three methods we should use, have we lost equipoise on selecting DMPA? These things are unknown, frankly, and they're anybody's guess, and it's really going to be a matter of very sensible, as Gerard said, sensible, logical discussion and careful thinking to think which methods we put into this. There's no right answer, and all of the proposals are right in some way or another. Over.
Great. Thank you both. You know, someone also had a follow-on question related to ECHO, and for advocates who believe that this kind of trial is necessary to happen, how and to whom should the advocacy be directed? Is it to the funders? Is it to WHO to say, you know, you really must reconsider this data if they are not considering it this week? Any guidance for advocates on the line? And that's a question for researchers and advocates alike on the line. Any thoughts?
Hi, Mitchell. Sorry, I have a printer running in the background.
No problem.
I think all of us should advocate for questions to be answered well and for questions to get their due consideration. I think if for those who feel that additional data will be needed or will be needed to change people's policy, one of those options is a randomized trial, for which I think many of us have worked very hard in the last year to try to see if that is a feasible option. And with very, very careful consideration and very, very careful discussion that I've been incredibly impressed with, that deserves its own advocacy. And I think advocating to say that this question needs to be answered and this is one way to answer that really helps that. At the same time, I think advocating all locally and nationally and then internationally at the WHO level to say that this question and these reproductive health and HIV questions are of importance, and that options and answers and clear messages need to be done, that's an advocacy point that I think all of us can do all wherever we are, locally, nationally, or internationally.
Great. And let me actually bridge from that back to you, Helen. A really super smart advocate partner in South Africa asked the question electronically about the new contraceptive policy in South Africa and about what its implications are and how it's working, and is it a lesson perhaps for advocates in other countries. So I wonder, Helen, if you could give some brief insights into the new contraceptive policy and its potential to shift dependence from injectables to other methods and what lessons we might draw from that.
The first thing is one of the drivers for doing the contraceptive policy was firstly that it was out of date, but also because of this accumulative, both the modeling data and the observational data that was building up. So that we first put an expert committee to look at that observational data, and we all felt that expert committee in South Africa had the same difficulties that the WHO expert committee had, which was its observational on the one hand and on the other hand. And so that is why the whole new policy was then said, well, we need to relook at the whole policy, and we need to do it against the broader background of HIV. So whereas previous policies would have, say, a chapter on women and HIV considerations, this policy is written totally against the background of overwhelming HIV prevalence. So that, you know, a third of the women in the 30 to 34-year-old age group are HIV positive. But all the women before and after, many of them are negative, the majority are still negative. And what does that mean for contraception? So to try and cover all the needs, and we also put in fertility counseling, because we felt that this was neglected. You know, we are doing PMTCT. We're very, very active for women who are positive. So the women who are negative tend to leave, go out of the door with very little in the way of intervention. So the whole policy was written in that context. The whole thing was written in that context. And what we did was we said the most important thing is to increase the method mix, because we've become so reductionist in South Africa and so reliant, very heavily reliant on injectables. And if further data suggests to us that over time, perhaps we have to be more decisive about DMPA, and we didn't feel we had enough data to say anything when we wrote the policy, but should further data become available, and this is why I would also strongly advocate for the randomized trial, but what we did was we reintroduced the copper IUD and trained up people, and numbers have gone up significantly, and we've newly introduced the implant. So what we're doing is widening the method mix. So should, in the event, further good quality data become available that would mean that the policy around using DMPA would need to be changed in the context of high HIV prevalence, we've already set the scene with offering women, training up and offering women a range of contraceptives that means that they're not going to be left without choice, and that we're not also going to impact on maternal mortality adversely by removing something that so many women want to use and are reliant on. Over.
Great. Helen, thank you so much. So I think, you know, that was very much South African-driven, both researchers and broader community. So it sounds, you know, back to Jared, your point, that in addition to thinking about the trial itself and advocacy related to that, advocacy directed to WHO, certainly local, national advocacy directed at reviewing the data in the national context, as Helen, you just described, sounds critical. One other question is, go ahead.
I'm sorry, it's Anna.
Go ahead, Anna.
I just had sort of a quick question or comment or something. It's very interesting to hear that the WHO meeting is happening this week, and I think that's something that maybe those of us in the advocacy community need to really consider, and certainly something that we are, you know, maybe differently positioned or better positioned than researchers to do, is to think about whether it's important to make a statement, a collective statement to WHO immediately when the findings of this week's consultation comes out, and in response to those findings. I'm not sure when that will be, but it would be good to know. I think that for those of us like myself who really think that the ECHO trial in some iteration urgently needs to go forward, we might want to think about advocating to WHO to call for that additional research for a randomized controlled trial. It may not be so successful for us to try to put put pressure on any one funder or a collection of funders to fund that trial, but I think that if WHO were to say that mobilizing funding to get the ECHO trial underway has to be a high priority in order to answer that question, I think that that would be a step forward, and I think it's something that we can very responsibly call on WHO to do, because if WHO is sitting with data that they recognize may not be sufficient to answer the question definitively, then the next step, it would seem to me, would be for WHO to say, you know, funding is needed to mobilize the research so we can respond to this definitively. And it's something that, you know, is primarily an issue for women, and it needs to be an issue for women, positive and negative women, to take forward with all of our allies as a reasonable demand, in my opinion.
Beautifully said, Anna, and certainly a high priority, I think, for a number of us. And Emily Basson from AVAC and colleagues from ICW East Africa have been tracking on this and with the Athena Network very closely. And I think the preparation of something in advance of whatever WHO does say is exactly right. Anyone that is interested in engaging with Anna and ICW and Athena and AVAC, if people want to be in touch with Emily directly at emily@avac.org to help facilitate that would be terrific. But one of the pieces, I know we're a little bit over the hour, but just one other related piece is a question actually for anyone on the line, but also I think related to what Anna described. In addition to WHO, another major driver in the discussions related to expanding contraceptive options and availability has been the so-called FP 2020 or Family Planning 2020, the initiative that grew out of the London Summit a couple of years ago. And I guess first a question that came in from an advocate on the line, have any of the researchers, I don't know, Lisa or Helen or Jared, have any of you briefed the FP 2020 leadership on these data? The most recent statements from FP 2020 have certainly been supportive of expanding method mix, but have been totally absent any conversation related to the issue of hormonal contraception and potential HIV risk. And I wonder if any of you as researchers have briefed FP 2020, and then perhaps hear from any advocates on the line for how we might direct engaged advocacy not only to WHO but also to FP 2020.
Thanks, Michael. Great question. I can say no, not in any sort of official way. We haven't, at least in our group, we've not done any briefing about the 2020.
Great. And Helen or Jared, any knowledge of conversations about this with FP 2020? Oh, Helen, are you trying to speak? Hello?
I'm still here.
Oh, go ahead. I was going to say, I wasn't sure if either you or Jared or anybody from the ECHO team has had a chance to discuss this with the FP 2020 initiative and how this relates to their work to scale up contraceptive availability.
Well, I kind of sort of obliquely, there is an engagement because some of the senior folks who are engaged in discussing the ECHO trial also involved in FP 2020. So, for example, Marlene Timmerman, who heads the RHR and WHO, is also involved in the FP 2020 discussions. The new head of contraception at Gates is also involved. So there's a sort of interplay there. The other thing is that this is an area, and Melinda Gates has got a real personal interest in FP 2020. And is very supportive, as is Bill as well. But Linda's very interested in this field and is very interested in the ECHO study. So, you know, I think that in that sense, it's not been a formal discussion, but many of the role players involved in FP 2020 are involved in obliquely, or directly in ECHO.
Really helpful. I realize we're over time. I do think, though, coming out of these last few comments, I think perhaps a really clear advocacy strategy to develop that relates to first and foremost the WHO process and the evaluation and review of the emerging data and to ensure that that happens. I think secondly related to clear voice of support for filling in the data through a trial like ECHO, and knowing that what it's composed of in its arms will evolve to engage advocates in that. And I think lastly, to really pick up on the last point from Helen, knowing that there's a lot of overlap to be sure that there is as clear a conversation and messaging coming out of FP 2020 related to the emerging data as there is to contraceptive availability generally. Certainly are all priorities coming out of this call. And again, at the outset of this whole call series, we really wanted to build off of the AVAC report, which we published just at the end of last year, which actually made a very forceful plea for full support of, at the time, a four-arm trial. And we are keen to work with any and all on the line and with partners all over the world to ensure that this is addressed in a comprehensive way. We've not gotten to all the questions that have come in, and I apologize for that. We will be continuing to update it. I should also say, with the new information emerging, the issue brief that's currently on the AVAC website is being updated with the more recent data. We will circulate that to all of you on the call via the ReadyTalk follow-up. It will be a draft, and we'd welcome any input about what more can or should be said in that overview or in other materials that may be helpful to advocates. But perhaps I'll just say any last words from anyone on the line? You can hit *7 and unmute, and I apologize that we haven't gotten to all the questions, but any last comments? And I don't know if Margaret, you're on from ICW in Uganda, but I know you were on earlier, but any thoughts from ICW where you play such a leadership role in the conversation in Africa? Well, I believe we may have lost her at the top of the hour. I apologize. Any closing thoughts from anyone else, from Helen, Jared, Lisa, or anybody else on the line? *7 again.
Just thanks very much to you, Warren, and to AVAC and everyone there who's worked so hard to keep up with this really complex field and all the emerging research. I think we all who are working on this question in a research capacity, really appreciate the fact that AVAC continues to advocate for clear messages for women in this wider sector.
Great. Well, thank you so much. And I guess I should also say that when I was kind of doing that quick summary related to the trial and WHO and to FP 2020, I think one of your key points coming out of the Aspire experience is the real clear need for advocacy related to the method mix, not just saying we should do it, but actually being able to harness some of the experience and innovation that is clearly happening in the Aspire trial, and I know it's also happening in the FACS 001 microbicide study that Helen leads with Glenda Gray in South Africa, that there are ways to expand the method mix even in the absence of clarity on the data. And Helen and Jared, any last thoughts?
I think the most important thing here is from the advocacy community. I think people can weigh up what they want to say themselves. I don't think this is something where one expert has the final word because we're in a gray zone. Everyone can look at the new data and can decide what they feel the imperative is. Is there an imperative for a randomized trial? I think what we're saying is that even with the new data, if you look at the voice study, you know, you've got this funny result, which is HSV2 positive drives increased incidence of DNPA and HSV2 negative doesn't. And for all of these to's and fro's and this uncertainty, this is why we're advocating for a randomized trial. But I think in terms of what the field wants to do and wants to ask WHO to do, I do think that people should look at the data and then should come to their own conclusions and be very brave. This is a dialogue. The global dialogue and a continuum of opinions is healthy and really pushes the field. But very importantly for this group is not to take one's eye off this because we haven't answered this question yet.
Great. Thank you, Helen. Jared, any last thoughts? Oh, go ahead.
I just want to remind the expert with the last word.
Sure, I might have the last word, but I'm no expert, so go ahead.
No, I don't want any last word on it. I think you know, for many of us, and myself included, who have worked, who have thought about this question for, you know, a decade, decade and a half, for more, it's very, very encouraging to see that it is a conversation, an advocacy conversation, a policy conversation, a clinical conversation. I think what we can all do is make sure that we can be trying to speak for clarity and to get clear messages. And if we need data to get clear messages, and then we should figure out what the best way to get those kind of are. It's very encouraging, though, that we're actually having this conversation so well right now. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Jared. And again, not an expert here at all, but I will provide the last word of thanks to all of you on the line, and especially those who've stayed till the bitter end. And I will say that one of the things that came up last week at CROI that I think can't be emphasized enough is whether you support a trial or not. And as Helen rightly said, it's a gray zone, and people will make their own individual decisions and perspectives. But whether there is a trial or not, there will be inevitably a period of continued grayness, whether that is a number of years until we get a result from a trial, or forever if the trial never happens to answer the question definitively. There are questions about what to do and how to do it now, and that is something that we mustn't forget, whether you are for a trial or not. What do we need to be doing in real time to ensure that saying we should expand the method mix is not just said because we don't know what else to say, but it's actually something to be done. And again, we have examples of how it can begin to happen through clinical trials, but also, as Helen described, in the South African contraceptive policy and advocacy directed at national levels to ensure we see more things like that. This is a conversation. This is not the first webinar of its type, and it will surely not be the last, but it continues to evolve, and very grateful to all of you to be on the line. We will be sending a number of follow-ups out. Thank you, Lisa, Jared, and Helen for being on and providing the background for us. And anyone who does want to follow up specifically on critical next steps in real time around advocacy related to this issue, please let us know at either avac@avac.org, or you can email emily@avac.org. And we will look forward to many more opportunities for the discussion, but also for action to move this forward. So thanks very much, and have great days and evenings going on.